Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, it's well known that bees play a crucial role in supporting ecosystems by pollination. We could probably survive in a world without bees, but it'd be pretty much grimmer. Not only would we have to get by without honey, but many of the foods we currently enjoy would likely disappear. Bees aren't the only pollinators of plants and vegetables. There are wasps and bats and butterflies and such like, but bees are easily the best. Food insecurity would rise and we'd be financially worse off because bees are a significant benefit to the global food industry. We also know that bees are in danger. The International Union for Conservation of Nature says nearly 10% of wild bee species in Europe may be at risk of extinction. So, is sustainable beekeeping the answer? What does sustainability mean in this context? And is keeping bees itself inherently harmful? With me to discuss this fascinating topic are three brilliant guests. Paul Horton is a commercial bee farmer and director of the Bee Farmers Association. Hello there, Paul.
Hello.
Great to have you. And Nicola Bradbear is Director of Bees for Development, a charity working to alleviate poverty through beekeeping. Hello, Nicola.
Hello there.
And Anne Robry is a master beekeeper and president of the British Beekeepers Association. Hello there, Anne.
Hello. Good to meet you.
Great to meet you all. Well, fantastic to have you all on the podcast. But first of all, let's just start with the absolute basics and talk about bees and honey. How do bees make honey, Anne, and why do they make honey?
Basically, honeybee population within a hive is about 40,000 to 60,000, of which the majority are worker bees. Those are the females. Why do they make honey? They make honey because honeybees survive as a colony through the winter, so they have to have something to eat. So the worker bees are going out during the spring, the slightly warmer weather, and the summer. They're trying to collect food, storing it for the winter. How do they do it? They need to get out to a flower. They land on one of the flowers, and they can be guided in because flowers actually have a UV signal on quite a lot of them, which will point the bee in the right direction to where the nectar is being stored within those flowers or in the vegetables, wherever they're going. They land on it. They then extend their proboscis into the nectar and they suck it up and it goes back up their proboscis. It does not go into their digestive system. It goes into a special little honey vessel called a honey stomach. And that's quite important, really, because it's not mixing with the whole of whatever else is going down their esophagus. From there, it is, as they're coming back, it is stropped because it's quite high content of water in it. So they're flicking their tongues in and out, trying to actually get the water to evaporate off their tongues. They bring it back into the hive and then they actually pass it on to other bees. And they do it for two reasons. One is they want the majority of it to be stored, and some of the bees are doing that. They're going up to the little cells they put it in, which are made of wax, which some of the workers in the hive have been working on, and store it in there. And then the bees have got to drive water content down to be below, it's usually between 18 and 20%. When they're doing that, they're fanning with their wings and they work very hard within the hive to do that. And then once it's gone down to about 18, it's usually under 20%, they will then cap it. Before they cap it, they put a few substances in, some of which are still being worked on to find exactly what they are, but they add a little hydrogen peroxide to actually make sure there's no fungus development or disease development within the honey. They cap it over with wax, which means that it is then totally protected, and it will last for 1,000 years or more, as long as we don't interfere with it. That's why it can be found in places like the Egyptian pharaoh's tombs. The honeycomb in there with honey in it, which you could actually, if you wanted to, still eat. Once they've stored it, that's their job done for the winter, and that can be put aside for the winter. The other thing that they're doing with the nectar when they bring it in is sharing it with a lot of bees. That's where they're doing a little dance as well. And they do it on the comb, which is in total darkness. So the bees are actually feeling what they're doing. And they are translating for those bees through the waggle dance exactly where to go out and find that group of flowers. It is incredible what they do. They work tirelessly. And it's worth realizing as well that in summer, the little worker bees work so hard, they actually work themselves to death. And they only live about 3 to 6 weeks. But they do a fantastic job, and they produce so much honey. As beekeepers, we can afford to take quite a lot off them, and they still have enough to go through the winter, although sometimes we do have to feed them as well. So that's just the basics of how they make honey, obviously. There's a lot more complex issues than that. But those are the basics of them. But in collecting the nectar, they go to thousands of flowers, not just one or two. They're visiting groups of flowers, and they're collecting nectar from thousands each day. So what they're bringing in their lifetime, probably no more than a quarter to a half a teaspoon of honey each, which is why having 40,000 in a hive, we then have plenty of honey which we can take off, because so many bees are working so hard, and we can take, well, maybe 30, 40 pounds, I should say, 20, 30 kilos off them, depending on where they are, what they're doing, whether they have been used just for pollination or whether they're used for collecting nectar. Several ways in which the bees can be used by beekeepers. They are incredible insects, and we should be proud to actually be the custodians of them and looking after them, because really, that's what we need to do. We need to take care of our bees.
Yeah, fantastic. That's a brilliant description of an incredibly complex process. And you touched a little bit on the pollination side of it. So, Nicola, can you paint a picture of just how important bees are to our ecosystem?
Yes, they're fabulously important. The reason that flowering plants have flowers is to attract their pollinating insect. And many of those pollinating insects are bees, but as you said, there's other insects too. But the thing about honeybees is that they produce honey, and that incentivizes us humans to care for them. But if we look after bees, then we kind of look after the whole ecosystem for bees and other pollinating insects, and indeed other insects that are absolutely crucial for life on Earth. We can't manage without insects, not just for pollination, but they do so many services at the bottom of the food cycle. So more or less every bird, even a seed-eating bird at some stage of its life cycle, depends on being fed insects, or insects in some stage, maybe it's caterpillars or larvae. Insects are absolutely crucial for the whole ecosystem, and honeybees are part of that. And we can't have life on Earth without insects. That's how we've evolved. And there's this fantastically interesting relationship between flowering plants and their pollinating insect, which has evolved over millions of years, long before humans were on Earth. It's very, very complex, but flowering plants and bees depend on one another. You can't have one without the other. So they're absolutely crucial for our survival, and they pollinate something like 80% of food crops. So yes, completely, completely crucial for our survival.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Paul, let's move on to the bit from being crucial to the ecosystem to being crucial to the food industry itself, which I guess, you know, we need to assume some sort of responsibility for them as well. Can you give us some specifics though on how much bees contribute financially and constructively, both directly and indirectly, to the food industry?
Well, I would say there are two main ways that bees are contributing financially to the economy. Let's say. The first is the obvious one in honey production as a food produce. Each year, obviously it varies from year to year depending on the season and the conditions, but we're producing something like 4,000 to 6,000 tonnes of honey in the UK each year, which may have a value of something like 50 to 60 million for the economy. But the larger contribution is through pollination, as Nicola has touched on. You know, honeybees are fantastic pollinators and very efficient at what they do. And, you know, there are two types of pollination, really. There are kind of indirect pollination, which may be from people with bees in their back gardens, and those bees forage for several miles around that hive. So that can encompass all kinds of, you know, agricultural crops and orchards and things like that. And there could be a large number of colonies within a few mile radius. So the second way is a direct pollination, which is sort of migrating colonies directly onto a flowering crop or an orchard for pollination purposes. And that could be pollination of apples, cherries, oilseed crops, field beans, all kinds of food produce. And through that direct kind of pollination, you should be seeing a 10, 15, 20% increase in yields for that crop, which is quite significant if you consider that in an increase in food production for us as a nation, really. Government estimates suggest that pollination is valued at something like 600 million, which is significant.
Yeah. So excuse me for being a bit blunt, but is there money to be made, Paul, in beekeeping?
Like all farming, it's not easy. And there's a lot to it, but there can be if bees are managed well, and we put a lot of hours in and a lot of effort, a lot of energy into it. You know, there are plenty of us out there, 450 of us bee farmers out there making a living from this industry. We're not going to be millionaires, but we're making a living. We're eking out a living. Yeah.
And that's fantastic. It's a brilliant sort of cycle going on that you're propagating as well, which is really exciting as well. Now, and we've heard a lot, certainly over the last couple of years, about the fact that bee populations are falling. Can you give us some idea of the scale of the fall and tell us why they're in decline?
Yeah, basically, there's a lot of issues which impact on the bees. Just to give you a sort of very quick couple of figures about it, and it says here that we've got increased crops to be pollinated, as the bee farmers are well aware of, and there are less people that are actually keeping large numbers of bees, and we've got a decline in the number of beekeepers. We have in the UK a huge number of hobby beekeepers, but on the majority of those are keeping 3 to 4 hives. They're not doing a lot of pollination services. Some of them will take the bees up to the heather, get crops from there. We've got instances of climate change. Climate change all over the world. Bees all over the world are certainly actually, they're really suffering because of that. Some areas are getting very dry. We noticed it this summer in the UK. We didn't have enough rain. Flowers were there. We could see them. A lot of them were still flying, but they weren't producing any nectar. And in fact, a lot of beekeepers like me were actually having to feed our bees in June. It's normal that we have to keep an eye on them to make sure they've got enough food. But again, that's expense. If you look at the way that the economy is going in this country, how expensive petrol is, how expensive sugar is, you're actually getting beekeepers saying, and I hear them saying, well, I don't think I'll be taking my bees up to the heather this year. I don't think I'll be going, putting them over to the rape. There are certain issues which are making it very difficult because beekeeping is becoming expensive. I think, as Paul said, there are bee farmers doing a fantastic job supplying honey. We only supply a very small percent. I think it's about 10% of the honey that we need in this country. We can't supply it all. We have to have imports of honey. Unfortunately, I think you probably all heard about it, that we are getting a lot of honey from non-EU and EU groups coming in now because of the way in which we have to label things, and it is blended. And it comes from a lot of different countries. Unfortunately, we have a lot of honey coming in from China, from East Asia. There's adulterated honey. The Chinese honey has not increased in price more than about 10% in the last 5 or 6 years. We look at the other honeys which are being produced genuinely in other countries, which is gradually going up and up. And if I look at honey here in this country, it used to be sold about 5 years ago for about £3.50, £4 a pound. But it's now virtually doubled in price to try to actually, people sell the honey so they can afford to buy the wax and the food for the bees for the winter. Hobby beekeepers are not looking at making great profits from it. But unfortunately, the Chinese, and I'm just absolutely blatant about this because I know it has been tested. I know that we did a lot of work, and the Han UK charity actually sent jars of honey from different countries from our supermarket shelves over to Germany to the excellent testing laboratories in, I think it's Länderbar, but I might be wrong about the actual area that it's in. But Germany are the ones which do the full testing. We've got the facilities here, but we don't use them for that specific purpose. And they found that virtually every jar of honey that was being imported into the UK was actually adulterated.
And when you say adulterated, what are they adulterated with?
They adulterated on the whole with corn syrup or rice syrup. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say that some of the things that are coming in, they're adulterated with different chemicals and extractions from plants, known as probably C4. Some of the honey sent in actually hasn't seen a bee, let alone be collected by bees. And they're sending in these cheap syrups. They come in labeled on the label as non-EU and EU. We've actually tried to lobby the government about this. We've asked them for new labelling. We've put up petitions saying to the government, please get labels done properly, saying when foodstuff comes in, it's labelled with the origin of where it comes from, the country it comes from. The only thing we're asking them for, could you put the percentage added for each country? Well, the reply from the government that I received just said, we can't put the percentages on, we blend the honey when it comes in, and therefore we don't believe that the customers buying the honey will understand what it means if we put the percentage coming from each country, which I think is a total insult to the people of this country buying honey.
Yeah.
And I do think that's if we could improve the actual labelling, people could make a choice as to where the honey comes from.
Yeah. Okay. So, Paul, let's talk about industrialised methods of beekeeping. So adulteration is one issue, but how about industrialised methods? So, you can buy a jar of honey for under a quid in some supermarkets. You can also happily pay over £6 for another jar. And often they have different taste profiles and things like that. How does industrialised beekeeping work? And is there a vast difference? Why is the price so different between different types?
Well, when you speak of honey that's a pound, that is surely something that has been adulterated. It is almost impossible for us in the UK to get a jar of honey as low as that price. It is impossible. The costs are just too high. Realistically, the costs involved with importing that amount of honey are not low either. So
the jar alone is a large part of
absolutely.
The cost, isn't it? Yeah,
you have to question why a product is that low in price. You know, and people can do what they want with their money. Some people prefer that £1 jar of honey. That, you know, maybe they'll prefer the flavour, but you should really be questioning the legitimacy of that kind of honey at that price, I think.
But let's put legitimacy aside for a second, because I think Anne's talked about that in quite a lot of detail. Can you describe how industrialised beekeeping works and how it compares to smaller scale beekeeping?
Well, realistically, it's the same. It's just on a larger scale. You know, the management technique's the same. The care for the bees and what they require is the same. It's just on a larger scale. So we keep more hives potentially in an apiary. We maybe utilize the hives more through migratory beekeeping. So following crops around even the entire UK. You know, myself, I migrate crops for pollination of apples and cherries. Then they come back to oilseed rape and field beans.
Can you just give us an explanation of how, when you say you migrate them, do you literally take 50 hives, stick them on the back of a truck and drive them somewhere?
On the back of a truck, on the back of a trailer, usually prior to nighttime when the bees are inactive and all the hives are inside, we will load them up, and that causes low stress then when it's dark and cold and the bees are inactive. So we can transport them long distances then and place them somewhere where there'll be a bounty of forage for them.
And presumably you have to make an arrangement with the place that you're going to, a farmer there. And,
yes.
And how long do you leave them there for?
It usually depends on the flowering period of where we're migrating them to. In one way, this is why migratory beekeeping is quite beneficial, because we're moving the bees in to take advantage of a 3 or 4 month flowering period of one crop. That crop begins to go over, the bees then move on to another crop, and so on and so forth. So they're continually kept active. They're continually foraging. And honeybees are quite incredible creatures, really, that they're actually at their best when there is an abundance of forage available. And by migrating them, we find that they're continually kept healthy and strong and productive throughout the entire season. Whereas if you keep your bees in one locale, for instance, there are certain times of the year where there may be a dearth of forage, gaps where there is little nectar available. And the bees have to navigate those periods by consuming their own stores, until we get to a period where there is an abundance of forage available for them again. Mm. So, on a commercial scale, we're kind of just working closely with other wider agriculture, with farmers and growers, and gaining a mutual benefit of honey production for us and pollination from them.
Do you ever get paid to bring your hives to a certain place?
Often early in the season, apples and cherries, we're paid to pollinate those, usually because it's early in the season, requires a bit more prep work, and obviously not many people are well prepared to move colonies. So it is a thing that really benefits from a payment for us. It makes it a bit more lucrative for us to put the effort in there.
And how many hives will a farmer like you run?
I'm sort of mid-scale. I manage around 300. We do have members with thousands, but many of our members now have 50, 60 colonies and make a living from that on some scale. On the smaller scale of things, most people are selling all their honey in jars to sort of try and maximise the profitability of that product, whereas larger scale, they'll be dealing in barrels of honey.
Yeah. And how much of that is sort of being sold under your own brand, where you're literally, you know, carting a couple of boxes of jars to the local farmers market or hopefully supermarkets, but probably sort of smaller scale retailers?
It varies from bee farmer to bee farmer. I'm about 30% of what I produce is going directly to my local area, to shops and garden centres, or we sell through our website. But
And there's a prestige value to that as well, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. A local product that people can trust, and they get to know me and they get to know the local beekeepers in their area, and they can trust that product has come directly from them. And I think once it goes out of our hands sometime, that trust is lost, even though the end product is the same under a different brand on a supermarket shelf. For instance, it's still my honey or another bee farmer's honey. It's still a good product, but you lose that traceability a little bit. I think you lose the trust there maybe sometimes, I think.
Yeah. And what's your view of there are a fair amount of organizations in London, often East London, around the area of Shoreditch, I would suggest, where people have their own hive or two, and they'll sort of talk a lot about their own urban beekeeping. Is this actually valid bee farming, or is it vanity beekeeping?
Certainly in urban environments, specifically London, it is known to be a difficult place to keep bees, that there are far too many colonies in certain places of London specifically. You think it's an urban environment, that there is little forage available. When you think of the area that a colony would forage on could be a couple of mile radius, but if you've got hundreds of colonies within that radius, that forage is then spread quite thin. So certainly urban environments are not the best places to keep bees now, I would say. And there are places of the countryside that are, say, predominantly straight grass pasture land. These are not good places to keep bees either. So it's really, as a beekeeper, trying to best understand, and it takes time, but best understand the capabilities and the forage that is available surrounding you and managing the number of hives to suit that.
Can I jump in a bit there, Paul?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's a bit sweeping to say that it's not good to keep bees in an urban situation. There's bees kept in cities all over Britain, Ireland, Scotland, very successfully. I totally agree with you. There are too many, and the density is far too high in parts of London. Part of that is the popularity that beekeeping has got in the last few years. Beekeepers actually declined in number. I think it was between about 1985 and 2005. The numbers really dipped right down, and they declined by about 50%. That's the hobby beekeepers.
Mm.
Since then, there's been publicity about bees need help, bees need this, bees need that, and beekeepers have become, it's become a lot more popular. Putting it on roofs in London and small places and balconies is not the best. And it's not just difficult from the collection of forage and honey, as Paul's pointed out. It's also because those bees, not being managed by people who are actually very experienced, those bees will swarm and they will cause problems by getting into the wrong place, people's roofs, appearing in, you know, areas where they have to be moved, and it can be very difficult. But there are a lot of very successful beekeepers working with bees. And I work on the edge of Bath. So some of my bees are actually in Bath. Some of them are right next to the canal in Bath, and that's right in the middle near the cathedral. And they do very well there. One of the reasons they do well is that there's also been a big emphasis on pollinators in general, not just honeybees, but the importance of getting lots of variety of flowers and forage for them. That's people planting up the verges with flowers. Councils are doing it on their roundabouts and things. They suddenly realise they don't need double dahlias and things that don't produce nectar on their roundabouts. They can have wild flowers. They can have things which are good for pollinators. There's been a big push on that. It's made a big difference.
It does sound as though there's been a lot more understanding of these other issues. Now, I'd like to bring in Nicola here. We're sort of verging on talking about welfare for bees here and about how best to make them thrive, which makes me think, is there an ethical side to this? Are there unethical practices in beekeeping, in industrialised beekeeping? Do these things crop up, and are they a tangible problem, Nicola?
Well, beekeeping varies all around the world, of course. In some countries, it's practiced on a huge scale and is extremely industrialized. Many people have seen maybe films of beekeeping in California in the almond orchards. The poor bees feed for a whole month on almond nectar and pollen. And that's kind of like making any one of us just eat the same food for a whole month. You end up with bees that are stressed and not fit. So beekeeping is a very funny subject. You know, it's practiced at all different scales.
Mm.
Paul's described a sort of perfect case where he's beekeeping and selling his produce direct to the consumers so they can have confidence in his product. But I'd like to say that there are many countries around the world where people are doing wonderful beekeeping, and they're producing more honey than can be eaten in that country. If you look at Ukraine, it's one of the big honey-producing nations, and they're exporting wonderful honey. I don't really like hearing it, the idea that all imported honey is fake honey. It's not the beekeepers that are adulterating honey. It's somebody in a factory somewhere putting, you know, fake product onto the market.
The beekeeping brotherhood is clearly strong here. I like that. So if we let's add to this the moral question of whether or not we should be taking honey from bees. Can you help us to understand how that works?
Well, a honeybee colony is, you can imagine it as really something like a small mammal. It's a superorganism, but if you starve a honeybee colony, that's the same as starving your dog or cat. It's exactly the same. If you take off all the honey, you've taken away all their food and they will starve. But beekeepers don't do that. They take off honey, and if the bees need food, you can take off the surplus and leave honey behind for the bees to feed on. Or if you take off all their honey, which isn't really best practice, then you would feed them with sugar syrup or fondant to provide them with food instead. But obviously, none of us would, you'd all rather eat honey than white sugar. We don't want to eat that. So, you know, let's not make our bees eat it. But that's what we do. And nowadays, as Anne said, we even have bees starving at crazy times of year when it wouldn't have happened before. And then beekeepers help their bees by feeding them with white fondant.
Sounds quite nice, to be honest. So, again, briefly, but as you say, briefly, it would be quite nice. So, Paul, I mean, is it possible to be a bad bee farmer and make a lot of money? Because presumably these little insects are incredibly sensitive. And if you don't treat them properly, the colony will die out, or you won't get enough honey. So can you farm bees badly and make lots of money from them through bad welfare?
I think, as Nicola suggested, that there are places in the world where the beekeeping is more intensified. Certainly in America, almond pollination is a very intense and lucrative industry, and much of their beekeeping is geared up towards that. And as Nicola again said, certain monocultures where the forage is just from one specific type of plant can be detrimental to the bees. In the UK, at least, we're quite beneficial in that we're often surrounded by a variety of different floral sources. And from my experience in the industry, I would say that the scale that we work at in the UK, we have very good practices, and we do a very good job of looking after the bees and caring for their needs. It's only ever in our interest to see them healthy and thriving and productive, really, because the most profitable colonies are the ones that are the strongest and most productive, really. So we only ever strive to see them thriving in the UK, from my experience at least.
And is there a fair amount of regulation around beekeeping?
There are regulations, some regulations regarding in honey to make sure that we are producing a good quality and safe product. But regarding welfare or who can keep bees, no, there are none, sadly.
It's more about the food hygiene side of it.
Basically, but any other kind of livestock, you know, if you mistreat them or saw them come to harm, there would be repercussions. But we don't have that in beekeeping, unfortunately.
Okay. And what does, to your mind, Paul, what does sustainable beekeeping look like compared to unsustainable beekeeping?
Well, I guess I've just touched on it there, really. Sustainable beekeeping, to me, is healthy, productive colonies that we keep alive. You know, that there's nothing sustainable about letting colonies starve to death. There's nothing sustainable about letting colonies succumb to high infestation of varroa mites or diseases and things like that. So it's really, it is welfare. It is the quality of how we manage our livestock that is the heart of sustainable beekeeping, to me.
Yeah. Okay. So, Anne, how can consumers make sure that the honey that they're buying is either sustainable or actually honey or British at all?
Well, actually, the labelling is there, as Paul has said. Mm-hmm. It will give an indication whether it's from non-European or European countries and whether it's British honey. If we label it properly, we have to actually make it traceable with the ability to be able to trace it right back to the beekeeper. Beekeepers should have records on showing his hives as well and any treatment they've had. So it is traceable. Unfortunately, a lot of syrup is labelled honey. As Paul has said, it's really not honey. It's been proven not to be honey. And if it's very cheap, it should be indicative that there's probably not very much honey, if anything at all, in that jar. It's probably rice syrup or some other corn syrup. But we do have labelling. Unfortunately, what we don't have is a strong food standards organisation. They are so poorly financed, they struggle to actually deal with the main food. And honey is a bit of a side issue. It's not a main crop for them to be looking at. So we can point out that actually there is substances where it is saying honey and it's not properly labelled. They have never been prosecuted for not labelling their honey properly. The standards agency and the officers tell you, unless it's going to kill somebody, we're not going to really take them to court. So if anybody is taken to court over honey, it's so rare, it's got away with. But look, if you want good honey, you buy local honey, whether it's produced by a bee farmer or a beekeeper. But even better, find out where the beekeepers are and buy it direct from them. And you can do that. Yeah. BBKA, the British Beekeeping Association, has a map showing you on their site where the beekeepers are and therefore where you can get money or advice from getting money. And beekeepers generally produce very good honey, the same as bee farmers. If it's produced in this country, as Paul has said, it is usually sound, genuinely good honey. I was very worried about what was being said by Holland, I think it was, developing a honey which is called a honey from chemicals. They also sometimes will take, they don't take the honey, they'll take the nectar before it's ripened by the bees. And therefore, it hasn't got some of the components added by the bees in it. And it's just nectar straight from flowers. And they're actually driving the water off and calling that honey. A huge threat to bees is the Asian hornet. You may have heard about it in this country. We've had four over this year. I was in Spain at the end of last year talking to a beekeeper there who'd got several hundred hives, different places. She had lost 2/3 of her honey crop because if they come and they will actually attack in thousands. And if they start to attack a hive, what happens is the bees retreat into the hive and they cower and they won't come out. And some of the beekeepers are actually having to feed their bees to keep them alive so that they can get early spring honey before the Asian hornets actually build up. There's something which weren't about till 2004. They came in as one hornet in France. They are such successful insects at adapting. They've gone up through France, Portugal, Spain, Germany, Belgium, Switzerland, increasing in numbers, and they're beginning to come over here. And if we don't stop them, we'll be in the same position that Jersey are in now. You know, they did have 4 years ago two or three hives. They've now got 10,000 every year plus.
So how do you tackle the Asian hornet, Anne?
What you do is you need to get advice on how to put traps out. It's on the BBKA site. We also are very, very fortunate. We have a national bee unit in this country who actually help us with disease and pests which are attacking bees. But if you see an Asian hornet, you can see what they look like. We're trying to get a lot of publicity about the little black hornet type. Looks a bit like our European hornet, but it's black with yellow ends to its legs, yellow face, and a yellow band over its tail. And if you see one of those, you think it's one of those, take a photograph, send it to the British Beekeepers or to the National Bee Unit. On the website, you can see exactly and send it to the Central Ecology and Hydrology, I think it is, unit as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hope that some of our listeners will keep an eye out for the Asian hornet and register on your website. Now, Nicola, I just wanted to take a very brief moment, if you don't mind, to just tell us a little bit more about your charity. Now, we've heard about how complex bees are, how looking after them has to be a sustainable process. So, I presume that's a perfect way to go about helping to alleviate poverty. Can you just give us a brief explanation of what you're doing?
Thank you. Yes, beekeeping is a wonderful thing because I think earlier on in the conversation we were talking about it being small scale. That's the thing. Beekeeping can be very small scale, but it's very, very widespread. So all around the world, in almost every society, there are beekeepers and often they're people in remote places. But ironically, poor people living in remote places often have access to wonderful habitat, and they can do very good and successful beekeeping. And the wonderful thing about beekeeping is that in every society, honey and beeswax are high value food, that in every culture, somehow they have a respect and a value. And the people we work with, they have beekeeping with really no input costs. So they make the hives themselves, they make all of the equipment themselves. Where honeybee populations are fit and healthy, there are plenty of wild honeybees. So they obtain bees from the wild, which costs nothing. So the input costs can be low or zero, and yet they can harvest honey and beeswax, which have good value everywhere. So we work in kind of terrible places where there's chronic poverty, and honey is very often sold by the teaspoonful as a medicine and a tonic, not just something you'd eat every day, but it's a very special food. And so it's a kind of wonderful way to help some of the poorest people.
That sounds fantastic. Now, if people want to hear more about it, where would they go?
www.bees.org.
It's pretty clear, isn't it? I love that. Fantastic. Well, I'll take a look at that again as well later. Just one question for each of you, a slightly lighter note, because bees are clearly fascinating, and I'd give them a hug if they wouldn't sting me. Can you please give me one fact each? Actually, it could be more than one fact if you want, but your favourite fact or facts about bees. Perhaps you could start, Nicola.
Okay, well, honeybees have been around an awful lot longer than us, and perhaps they'll still be here long after we've gone the way we're going.
They're tremendously clever.
And once you kind of get into bees, you never really leave them again, because you just keep learning that they're so, so clever, and they've figured out how to do things. So my favourite fact is, and this has been very well researched, that the honeybee colony actually is a democratic organisation. They function very democratically. Every honeybee has an equal voice in deciding what the colony does. So they're a democratic society which has evolved over a long, long time. And if you want to read about it, the book Honeybee Democracy by Tom Seeley will change your life.
That's fantastic. And yet it's a monarchy. So, yeah, constitutional monarchy, perhaps.
It's not really a monarchy. It's not really. Okay. Each bee has equal choice.
Fantastic. Okay, Anne, what's your favourite fact about bees that you can give us?
Well, a little bit similar to Nicola's in a way. It amazes me the bees have been around since before the dinosaurs. They've actually evolved, they've adapted. They're incredible creatures. The thing I really love is as the bulbs are coming up in the spring, and it's the honeybees that start early, and they're out there. As soon as a little bit of warmth, they're working their little heads off. And I just think, wow, if we worked as hard as honeybees, we wouldn't have any problems in getting things done.
Absolutely. Okay, and Paul, your favourite fact about bees?
One that's always amazed me is that to produce a pound of honey, honeybees have to visit 2 million flowers, or around 2 million flowers. So think about that next time you're having a jar of honey and enjoying it.
Next time you're necking that honey and putting too much on your toast.
And every flower that the bees collect nectar from produces a unique honey. So there are hundreds of types of honey as well. So if you don't like one, you may love another. So
fantastic. Excellent. Well, Paul Horton, Nicola Bradbear and Anne Robry, thank you all so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. And remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe by your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.